Welcome to the ninth episode of the sixth season of the Ubuntu podcast. It's Wednesday the 24th of April, and in this episode we're going to discuss what's been in the news. We'll also talk about the latest happenings in the Ubuntu community. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat facility on the website and in the IRC channel. I'm Mark, and joining me this week are Tony.
Good evening.
Alan.
Hello.
And Laura.
Stop it with the deep breaths.
I found out at the weekend that professional actors do that sometimes too.
I don't believe it.
Yeah, they have editors though.
Yes.
There we go. Anyway, how are we doing?
Yeah, not
great.
Bad. Not bad.
Excellent. There's been a lot of news and community events happening recently.
Yes.
Really?
We should probably talk about some of those.
Let's do it.
Sounds like a fun-packed show.
Citrix has donated the Zen project to the Linux Foundation.
What's the Zen project?
It's a hypervisor for
running... What's a hypervisor?
Well, first the Earth cooled, then the dinosaurs came, and then so it's a hypervisor for running virtual machines on hardware.
It's the eighth or ninth most popular virtualization platform.
But it was
a stunning accolade, actually, isn't it?
Because it was quite popular a few years ago before virtualization started being supported on the hardware, because it did something clever, let you virtualize stuff.
It was also popular before there were any virtualization technologies built into the Linux kernel, and there was a long period where they were trying to get it in. But it was always a bunch of extra patches that you put on your Linux kernel and made a Zen kernel.
Yes.
Or a Zen-compatible kernel. And it was always a bit of a kludge, but a lot of people still use it. Mm-hmm. And then KVM came along, and KVM is in the kernel now. So, a lot of people use KVM instead of Zen.
For a while, it was the preferred Ubuntu virtualization solution.
Yes, for a short period.
About 2008, I think.
Something like that, yeah. I mean, I think they hope that having it in a neutral, non-profit foundation holding on to all their intellectual property is supposed to encourage other organisations to contribute to the development.
Because it's been, it's sort of changed hands a few times, hasn't it, throughout its life?
Well, yes. Originally it was a Cambridge University project, I think, and they spun it off to ZenSource, a separate company, and then Citrix bought ZenSource.
Right, okay.
And then it didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
It sort of stagnated for a while. Which sometimes happens when big companies buy open source projects. And it's nice to see it resurrected, but I remain to be convinced about how successful it'll be.
Especially given KVM is, in the kernel.
But, there are some big name users of the Zen virtualization technology. And apparently,
Bitfolk, in fact.
Yes, indeed.
When you say big names.
You don't get much bigger than Bitfolk, who very kindly host our podcast.
On a Zen VM.
Yeah.
So we want Zen to do really, really well.
No, I think we can migrate away to anything else, really, if we wanted to.
Google, Amazon and Samsung apparently are all heavy virtualization users using Zen. It's good that they have chosen to use that platform as an open source virtualization rather than paying Microsoft or going down the VMware route.
Mm. But they could have, paid Red Hat and got a KVM solution.
Yeah, they could have done.
Moving on.
Yes. And Samsung has admitted to hiring a marketing company to post fake positive reviews online for its products.
Ah, it's disappointing, isn't it?
It is.
You'd think there were enough people out there who really love Samsung products.
I know. Look at the TV over there.
It makes you wonder, though, how often this actually happens and goes undetected.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, it happens an awful lot because I get, even from the tiny companies who are probably less reputable, but I get, blog post spam, and it's clearly coming from faraway places and almost certainly orchestrated and paid pittance. I know people used to use the Amazon Mechanical Turk, which they pay a micro payment for a small amount of work being done, and if that small amount of work being done is write a review about my product and link to this website, that's what unscrupulous people used to do. It seems that that doesn't stop the bigger and more impressive your company seems to be.
Mm. Mm. And apparently they also pasted fake negative reviews against competing products.
Which is worse, really.
Well, it's all pretty shady, isn't it? None of it's great.
Yeah.
But I don't know, is that even worse? posting negative reviews?
Well, I suppose... No, I think it's actually probably about the same. either way, it's a fake. It's not a genuine review.
Yeah. But I suppose it's like a double whammy, isn't it? Because not only are you unfairly inflating one product's success ratings, you're also unfairly deflating another product's.
And that other product might not know what's going on, at least with yours. If you get caught out, you can just go, okay, Samsung's bad, let's not listen to their reviews. But who knows what other products they've been putting them on?
This happens to, like, a great degree in every walk of life. In every product. If you look at any big brands on, for example, Facebook, a lot of them will try and engage with their community by simply posting a picture or, you know, some inspirational photo and saying, like if you like this, share if you don't, comment if you think something else. And the only reason they're doing that is to get more likes, more shares, more comments. And if that's not, you know, trying to orchestrate people to like your product for free, you're not even paying anyone to do it, and you're not even asking people to do something nefarious. You're not asking them to write a positive review. You're just telling them to like a picture of a cat in some boots or something, you know. And it's horrible. I hate that. I hate the fact that people are being hoodwinked into pretending they like something when, you know, it's being spun as something else. It's horrible.
Red Tape, who's listening live in the IRC channel, suggests that reviews should always be a percentage anyway, rather than a good/bad. I'm not quite sure how that gets around this particular problem.
Yeah, and I mean,
I 100% agree.
But I find it increasingly, in fact, on Android apps. You'll install an app, you'll use it for 5 minutes, and the thing will pop up saying, oh, if you like this, why not push this button and give us a 5-star review?
Yeah.
Well, that is against the terms and conditions of using Google Play for a start. So, what's that app called? No.
Oh, I have. What frustrates me more is it's often with the games that are aimed at kids. So Sophie and Sam both use an Android tablet. And if I go to the tablet after they've been using it, there's a whole load of additional apps that they've installed, which is fine. You know, they can install whatever apps they want on there. But a lot of them, they will then have gone through to the Play Store and they'll have clicked like on stuff or plus one or whatever on stuff simply because in return they get coins or credits or something to play within the game, and they see it as harmless, you know, because they're kids and they don't realize that what they're actually doing is inflating the value of that company's product.
Well, we should leave this, I think, in the safe hands of the Taiwanese Fair Trade Commission.
They probably know what they're doing more than
isn't,
we do.
Isn't Samsung a Korean company?
Yes.
So why are the Taiwanese looking at this?
This was, I don't know, maybe it was perpetrated. Maybe the
Taiwanese
Taiwanese website or the marketing company might have been Taiwanese.
Oh, okay.
Maybe I should have researched this more thoroughly.
Yeah, me too.
Let's speculate endlessly.
Yeah,
let's
do that. We seem to do that quite well.
Oh, we could move on. Yes. So the government decided that they're going to sell off the Royal Mail. And prior to that, they discussed releasing the postcode address file. Openly. Right. And now it's been agreed that the file will stay with Royal Mail, who will then go private, and then it's up to them what they do with it.
Right. Pretty obvious what they're going to do with it.
Well, indeed.
So this was going to be a nice wadge of open data to complement things like OpenStreetMap by making it so that people could build software and companies could build services around this data, perhaps promoting certain enterprises which otherwise can't really happen because people have to pay a license fee every time they query the database.
Okay, so it's not a free thing to maintain, though, is it? It costs money to maintain a database of postcodes and whatever they relate to, addresses.
Yeah.
So why should the public foot the bill for this when
it's public data. It's the postcode is assigned to, you know, a street or an area or a region.
Yeah.
That's public data, very much like mapping data should be public data. Whether it, you know,
we don't have public mapping data.
No, we don't, and I think we should.
Okay, so something we don't have is also sort of like something else we don't have.
Yes,
that we should have.
Yes.
Okay.
But also the money to create that database in the first place
was public.
The money was public.
We funded the creation
of that public data. So why should it be kept private and used for profit when we could
The use cases that we were just talking about were small businesses and things being able to use it.
Being able to use it
for their own profit.
For their own profit, but also I would be able to use it freely, and anyone would be able to use it to, you know, make their own service or whatever using the data.
Right. So this is a list of postcodes and streets that they relate to.
Well,
or the location they relate to, and other data associated.
So a map reference, do you get that sort of thing out of them?
Map reference, I think, maybe
that kind of thing.
The ward and constituency they're in.
Right.
And so, at the moment, you have to pay for it?
But the investment has already been done many times over.
Mm. But it's not static.
No, it's not. But it's not... Well, it changes, but not dramatically. It's not like the whole country changes their postcode on a regular basis. It's like time zone data. It's something that is there and has to be there, and everyone should have access to it, in my opinion.
Wow, very good.
I can't imagine it would take a lot to automate updating it.
Well, there's been people who've tried to make free versions of it, in the same way that OpenStreetMap is there to make free cartography for the people. There was a group called Free the Postcode, where you're supposed to submit your postcode and where you are.
You basically take your GPS reference for your house, and you go to the website and you say, this is my postcode and this is my house, and it creates a database.
Yeah, effectively a duplicate of the private database.
Because it's not the contents of the database per se that is protected or...
Yeah, it is. Well, that's exactly
right. It's the database. It's not protected. You can't copyright the fact that my postcode is where my house is.
Right.
Because we talked about that with the time zone thing, didn't we? Yeah. It's like a particular instance of a given data set may be protected, but the information in it that London is in UTC 0, is not a secret.
Yes. So somebody could independently fund the collection of that information again into a different database.
Yeah, yes. Exactly the same way as OpenStreetMap have.
Mm. Yes. Yeah.
It's just no one's been sufficiently motivated to do it yet.
Yeah, and no one's got everybody in the country to log on to freethepostcode.org and have a GPS handy.
Yeah, and that's quite difficult because it's not just walking down the street. You have to know what the postcode is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway. Well, I'm convinced you've turned me around on that idea.
Well, Tim Berners-Lee was certainly in favour of the idea, predictably.
It must be right.
Tim Berners-Lee, inventor of the World Wide Web and founder of the Open Data Institute. I believe he's the founder. I wrote that there.
And he was mentioned in the Olympics, so...
Yeah, must be right. Yes.
Yeah, how did he get to the stadium, do you think? Did he use a postcode in his sat-nav?
But yes, he said that it flies in the face of the UK's commitments to open data, because there's recently been quite a lot of noise about things like research data in universities, the government saying that should be published openly and that all research papers should be open access.
Because they were funded publicly.
Exactly, because they were funded publicly. But this data is different, because then they might get a bit more money out of it when they sell it off, and therefore can fiddle the deficit reduction figures a bit more. Not that I'm cynical about this.
And it's not like the sale of public assets to private hands has ever caused a worse service for the public in the last 20 years or so in the UK.
Mm.
Yeah, so they could just release this cut of it that was funded entirely publicly and then let the... It's essentially a fork then, isn't it? The private thing can take it. They can carry on maintaining it with their own money, and somebody else can take it on and...
Yeah, well, the hope, Tim Berners-Lee's hope is that just because the government has said it'll stay with the Royal Mail doesn't mean that the Royal Mail won't say, OK, well, we'll release it then. But I think he might be being wildly optimistic.
Mm.
Interesting.
Apparently in, I think it was Norway, they did a similar thing and ended up having to buy the postcode database back from the company so that they could release it.
Right.
That just seems so wrong.
Excellent. Right, well, there we go. More postcode news next week, maybe. That's the end of the news.
The Ubuntu podcast needs you. Yes, you. If you hear something that pleases, puzzles, or piques you, tweet us at UUPC or email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. You can also talk to us on the telephone, Skype, Facebook, and Google+. Find links to all these places on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. And remember, if we don't hear from you, we might not have enough content. And that can only mean one thing. More quizzes.
It's time for community news.
And what's been happening in the community, Laura?
Well, somebody objects to the direction of the logo.
Yes.
It's, which logo?
It's not positive enough, the, Ubuntu.
The Ubuntu button on the launcher at the top left.
Yes.
It looks a bit like an Ubuntu logo, as if you're looking down the barrel of 007's gun at the start of James Bond. You know, with the swirls going round.
Okay. And is this an incitement to violence?
No. The swirls go the wrong way.
As they do in James Bond, though.
I don't know.
What's the wrong way?
To the left.
Anticlockwise.
And they should go to the clockwise. So Mark Shuttleworth got an email from someone who said this is a cultural mistake and you should correct it. And Mark said, right, let's file a bug, get it fixed.
Job done. Wow.
And so it was fixed. And that's it. Job done.
Because apparently...
Is it fixed as in marked won't fix?
No, it's fixed. Oh. It's properly... The button is now the other way.
Oh.
The swirls go the other way
around.
Well,
I'm glad that got sorted. Exactly. Because that's been bothering me for years.
Well, apparently it's a... All positive things go clockwise.
Okay.
I don't know whether that's entirely cross-cultural. I don't know.
Well, but looking... I mean, there were some arguments on the... fancy that. on the bug report. It just amused me. I just found it amusing. It's all done and it's all fixed and there's nothing to worry about, but it's that attention to detail, you see.
Okay.
Yeah. Gripping.
Software developer Brian Lunduk has blogged about the reality of sales figures on the Ubuntu Software Center.
Oh. Are they not what they seem to be?
It depends what you mean they seem to be.
It depends what your expectations are, really.
Well, he has one of the top 10 paid apps in the software center.
The number 10 top paid app.
Right.
That month.
Okay, so that, you know, he must be rolling in the dosh.
Yeah.
Apparently that equates to 23 sales.
Wow. So that's the 10th. Right.
The 10th most popular app.
Maybe there's a really steep drop-off.
Yeah.
And like number 1 and 2 are... The millions.
Maybe there are only 10 apps. Actually, I spoke to Laura Tchaikovsky, who works on validating some of these commercial apps. I think it's some 600 and something that she was working on in the last few weeks. So there's a lot in there, and he's in the top 10 of those 600. But with only 23 sales, that is an interestingly small number.
Yes.
Don't you think?
It is quite a small number. I mean... You think about how much some, like a game like Draw Something sold that was like millions of copies and therefore millions of dollars worth of revenue for a company.
And it's not like people running Linux or running Ubuntu even don't want to pay for stuff, because I'll go out and buy the Humble Bundle straight away and I'll impulse buy a game on Steam.
But here we go. You'll buy the Humble Bundle, which you buy from humblebundle.com, and you'll buy a game on Steam, which you buy from Steam.
Yep.
And you can install the Humble Bundle games through the Ubuntu Software Center, but you haven't paid for them through the Ubuntu Software Center.
This is like 5 years ago.
And I actually bought the game that he's talking about, an early version of the game that he's talking about. From his website. I didn't via PayPal. I didn't buy it through the Ubuntu Software Center. And part of the reason I didn't buy it through the Ubuntu Software Center is because I already had it and I knew what the game was. But there's nothing that I personally want in the Ubuntu Software Center that I don't already have. Or that I could get somewhere else for similar or cheaper price.
Yeah, that's the thing, because I could buy the Humble Bundle games through the Software Center if I wanted to, but I wouldn't get the pay
the
what
deal.
You want.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, and you don't get to see the little graphs and things.
Mm.
Yes, or have your name on the little number. Yeah.
I never pay enough to do
that. So, I mean, it's interesting, and I know the guys who run that part of the company are, you know, aware of this.
But the interesting thing is, I mean, Brian's quite a vocal guy. Anyone who used to watch the Linux Action Show will know that he doesn't, well, he does sometimes mince his words, but he, you know, speaks his mind quite vehemently, if that's the right word.
Vehemently.
Yeah.
Yes, there we go.
Didn't mince that one.
But he did. But the conclusion he drew from his blog post was that even though he's only sold 23 copies, it's still worth the effort of putting stuff on the Software Center, because it's, you know, it's a good thing to try and do, and with the potential that Ubuntu on the phone and tablet will bring to bringing more users to Linux in an environment where they're going to be used to buying stuff through an app store, it's worth being there already. because it might lead to more in the future.
Yep.
Yeah. And, yeah, that's over 200 a year if it was to carry on at that monthly rate. You know, that's adds up.
The Ubuntu One Music Store is to move entirely web-based, with the Rhythmbox integration being retired.
Yay.
Yay?
Yeah.
Why?
Because it's a pain having to launch Rhythmbox every time you want to buy something from the Ubuntu One Music Store.
Oh, I assumed that was in addition to...
No, they're actually ripping out the plugin, and they're doing a stable release update back to 12.10 and 12.04 to rip it out of those versions
That's
as well.
Interesting. Because,
So if you're using Rhythmbox, you then have to leave Rhythmbox to go to the website
to buy some music.
But then, isn't there a handy button in the launcher to launch the website?
Yes.
As I found out when I logged into Unity to find it had been added to my launcher, along with a link to Amazon.
What release are you on?
12.10.
But you can you not still buy Amazon MP3s through a Rhythmbox plugin?
You may be able to with a third-party one, but not one that I don't think we've shipped by default.
Right, okay. But so if somebody still really, really wants to buy MP3s through Rhythmbox, there are ways for
They could write a plugin.
Yeah. Fair enough. Because, it's not just like the plugin isn't just like a wrapper for the web pages. It's actually a separately developed and maintained
proxy thing in the middle. Yeah.
And when they launched the website, people started using the website rather than using the plugin.
Yeah. Okay.
So, fair enough.
There's been a press release come out from VMware about a collaboration between VMware and Canonical to enable OpenStack clouds with VMware technologies. This is coming out of the OpenStack Summit. And it's basically, as it says on the tin, a collaboration between Canonical and VMware. Interesting to see that happening, the collaboration.
Has anybody else read this story?
Doesn't OpenStack, isn't VMware like their main competitor?
Don't know.
I wouldn't expect to see VMware being all happy and jolly and...
Well, as part of the OpenStack release...
We're so well informed.
As part of the OpenStack release on the 4th of April, VMware contributed code to add vSphere support to the OpenStack Compute project.
Oh, okay.
So they're obviously not, you know, at arm's length. They're obviously getting involved a bit.
Okay, then.
You know, maybe there's some sort of crossover. You can have a cloud that's combined with VMware and vSphere and
Maybe we should talk to someone from VMware. Do we know anyone from VMware?
No.
No.
No. Moving on.
Oh, well.
Okay, let's not do that then.
So Ivanka wrote a blog post of the design team at Canonical.
We should talk to her about that.
We should talk to her. In fact, we might well talk to her next week.
Okay, then. Well, keep listening.
Or if you're listening live, or if you're listening in about half an hour.
Yes.
Oh, yes. So my tweet wasn't completely wrong.
Yeah, all about design is really interesting. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes and you can read it up ahead of the interview.
Mm. Yes.
Yes.
Brilliant.
The link to the community page has been removed from the main page on the main navigation on the Ubuntu website, which isn't a good thing, is it?
Canonical are deprecating the community.
Outrage.
We are going
set
to be
set to maximum.
There's probably a plugin that allows you to switch it back again.
apt-get install community. Yeah. There was a bit of controversy about this, but actually what people didn't realise is there has been a project to recreate, rewrite and revamp the community pages on the website for a while, and it just wasn't finished.
Oh, I see.
When the website was revamped. So, right. You know, they
will be back.
Yeah, and I know Daniel Holbach has been coordinating input from various teams in order to update all those pages because they were outdated, and that's what his blog post is about, is to clarify the fact that actually the reason why they've disappeared is because people didn't actually step up and contribute to those pages. Mm-hmm. If they did, the pages would be there.
So Daniel was saying the community are a bunch of slackers.
Yeah, it's right. All your fault.
Right. Me?
Yes.
Okay. It's true, I didn't do anything.
I was going to say.
All right. Okay.
That sounds so surprised.
Didn't lift a finger.
Blame Tony. Cool. And then
Bite Mark have blogged.
Have they?
Yes, very excitingly. To basically encourage people to contribute to Geary.
This is the crowdfunded mail client which we were speaking about on the last couple of shows.
Yeah, yeah, and as we write, it's got 11 hours left.
And how much money to go?
Half.
Ah.
Yes.
Of okay. how much?
They want to raise $100,000 to finish Geary, and they've raised just over $50,000.
And this is one of the clients you looked at when you were switching to Mutt?
I looked at it, yeah. And I've installed it. It's on my machine, but I opened it once and it didn't quite work because it's not finished.
Not finished yet.
And so I don't use it.
But yeah, the gist of the blog post was that if we had something like Geary, then hosting companies would be able to offer an alternative to something like Gmail by having an IMAP server and offering people Geary as the client right. to use with it, which gives them the conversation like interface that Gmail gives them,
whereas at the moment people either go for Gmail or they go for an Exchange server and Outlook or something like that,
or they're given an Exchange server and Outlook.
Right.
Yes, it's interesting because I was wondering why Bytemark were trying to promote Geary as a desktop application, but now that becomes clear, so thank you for explaining that, Mark.
Shall we have some events?
Okay.
Upcoming round of the GNOME Outreach Programme for Women Internships will have application deadline on May the 1st and internship dates from June the 17th to September the 23rd. By having a programme specifically targeted towards women, GNOME have found that they reach talented and passionate participants who are uncertain about how to start otherwise. So if you're a woman and you'd like to get involved in the GNOME project, then we'll have a link in the show notes to how you can get involved in the outreach programme.
Yeah, it's sort of a bit like the Google Summer of Code, sort of a sponsored internship thing, but for GNOME, which is quite cool.
Cool. Mm.
There's a second Hack and Talk Day in June. It's on June the 29th in London. You can find out more at hackandtalkjune.eventbrite.com or hackandtalk.com.
And it's in the show notes.
Yes, and it's an event for people to come along and give a talk about something, not necessarily Ubuntu, not necessarily Linux, but something
geeky.
Yeah, something geeky. And also to hack on something. If you want to get a bunch of people together and motivate them to hack on something, you can do that too.
There's also a new Young Rewired State event taking place in Wales on the 6th and 7th of July. They're looking for 50 under 18 year olds who know how to program, not necessarily kind of assembler or something like that, but, you know, web development and Python, all that sort of stuff. And you can go along and help build something cool. And that project has given birth to a number of other sort of projects that have been adopted by government and things in the past. So cool. it's definitely worth getting involved.
It's all hacking on public data, isn't it?
Yeah, but not the postcodes.
Not the postcodes.
Because they don't exist.
Let's sigh.
And Raring Ringtail is due to release tomorrow.
Cool. Is it?
Wow.
Apparently so.
Is that a new Ubuntu release?
Yeah, I think so.
Yes.
13.04.
Yes.
Yes.
And how did you work that one out?
I counted on my fingers.
And so there is a release party in Dublin. Yeah. And it will be at the Porterhouse Temple Bar on Parliament Street obviously, 28th of April.
Yes. Well, the 28th of April is actually the weekend after the release. Yes. The release is tomorrow as we do this live.
Yes. I have no idea what day it is.
And as is always tradition in London, there's also a release party, which is at the Old Thameside Inn. And we'll put a link in the show notes.
And as is always tradition, I won't be going.
Because it's a weekday.
Yes. And it's in London.
That's all the super interesting and excitable events that Tony's brought a big downer on.
Well, it's... okay.
It's a school night.
I agree it's no rotating button, but, you know, it's still fairly interesting. Blimey. You can't please some people.
Oh, God. That's all for this episode. Join us next time when we'll be interviewing Ivanka Magic, head of Canonical's design team, reviewing your feedback, making your life a bit easier with some command line love.
Ooh, yes. And I think we've got quite a good command line love lined up for next time.
Yeah, it does sound
quite good.
Yeah, but this one's particularly quite good.
Ah, okay. That's better then.
Well,
it's quite very good. I think I won't go as far to say.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to change it now.
Join us next time. Bye-bye.
See ya. Bye-bye.